This is On Being's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Yo-Yo Ma. He is a Grammy Award-winning cellist. I spoke with him on March 5th, 2014, from Calliopeia Studio at On Being on Loring Park. He was at the studios of WGBH in Boston. You can download the MP3 of that produced show with Yo-Yo Ma at onbeing.org. Hello.
Is this the great Krista?
Is this the great Yo-Yo is the real question here.
No, you know, my wife and I listen to you, and we love whenever we get a chance, and you're just so wonderful.
Well, thank you. That means a great deal coming from you. I would say the same thing back. Yeah.
We listened, and then I would look up your name and find out, oh, my gosh, she went to Brown. Oh, my goodness. And then she went to Germany. And then it's like, oh, wow, she loves to cook. Oh, that's great. Well, and so it's such a treat, except that we're not in one room together.
I had hoped for that. But hopefully our paths will cross in. If physically, but you know, I'm sure you've done ISDN interviews. There's an intimacy to this, to just working with the human voice and
absolutely
really having
I've heard you say, yeah,
mm-hmm.
That's right. I've heard you say that sound is, you know, can be visual, and that that's and I think the whole way you structure the program and you know the way you listen, the way it is very intimate.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Well, I'm just thrilled to be in this space with you this morning.
Well, thank you. Are you in New York?
No.
You're in Minneapolis?
Yes,
no, we're
in Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm. Great. Great.
I mean, I'm in New York a fair amount, but this is where we produce the show.
And you live in Minneapolis?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Or St. Paul?
Yeah. I live in St. Paul, and our studio is now in Minneapolis. So.
Got it.
Yeah.
Got it. That's great.
It's not exactly like straddling Chinese, Parisian, and American culture, but, you know, practically. The trip from St. Paul to Minneapolis is a big deal here.
I mean, this is a definite boundary crossing here.
<It is. laughs>
We in St. Paul not deign to speak to those rascals in Minneapolis.
Right. Well, you know, some people say that St. Paul is the last eastern city and Minneapolis is the first city of the West.
Yes, that's great.
I guess it depends on what perspective you have on the world.
I know. I love that. This is really good. Oh,
yeah.
That's very funny.
Well, let's dig in. I just, I've been steeping. I mean, I've been listening to your music forever. And then getting ready for this, I've been reading a lot of other interviews you've given and things you've written.
Uh-oh.
And so, yeah, I'm
so
just going to jump in. I'm prepared. Yeah, yeah.
No.
And you know you were born to Chinese parents in Paris, and then you straddled another world when you moved to the U.S. as a child. And, you know, I want to ask the question this way. You know, was there a religious or spiritual background to that childhood of yours? You know, however you want to define that.
Well, I think that Well, as you can tell from the brief bio, I grew up pretty confused because, you know, there would be all these languages floating around, different messages floating around. And in terms of a spiritual worldview, you know, my mother was Protestant, my father was more or less Buddhist, and I grew up more or less Episcopalian, and you know,
confused. Okay, got it.
And so I think I've tried for all my life to make sense of things. Mm. You know, I remember as a 5-year-old thinking, you know, at the age when people want to, you know, say, when I grow up, I want to do whatever. I thought that what I really wanted to do was to understand.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, that was a 5-year-old's wish.
Yeah.
But that gives you a little bit of an indication on where my mindset was. And I believe that that was before we first came to the United States. Mm. So already I was kind of, you know, thinking, I wonder how things work in this world.
Well, that's definitely... That question then, I think, echoes through the rest of your life. So we'll keep coming back to that. Now, you had already given up the violin by the age of four when you took up the cello.
Well, at least I understood early on that certain paths go nowhere. Mm-hmm. I think I screeched and scratched on the violin, and I think to everybody's annoyance in my family. So I think I probably also disliked it, but I actually love the violin today. But I don't think I may not have had a natural physical affinity to it, which is a very interesting thing because we think of people who have talent to say, oh, you have musical talent, therefore you should be great at this. And I think that, here's an example of a kid who just didn't physically take to an instrument of the same family of instruments that he ended up with.
Right. And you have said that coming to the cello was a compromise and an accident. Can you tell that story?
Okay. The accident was after having been essentially my parents sort of gave up on my musical talent aptitude and thought, okay, the kid's not going to go into music. So, I was allowed to do all kinds of things, play in sandboxes, do whatever. And one day there's a very oversized double bass that's maybe about 8 feet, 9 feet high in the Paris Conservatory. We went by, saw it, and of course, as a four-year-old, something huge, something big. Oh, I like it. I want to play that. So I was haranguing my parents about saying, give me this instrument. And of course, it was, not possible for a four-year-old. And then the compromise was the next largest instrument, which was the cello.
And that gave us Yo-Yo Ma, the great cellist.
Yes. I'm a firm believer of accidental meetings between objects, people, circumstances. And because I so much of my life seems to have been orchestrated in that way.
So obviously you were gifted and you had an inclination to play. I mean, just reading between the lines, you must have, I don't want this to sound, you must have had something like, what we now call tiger parents. I mean, you obviously had a house where you were being very seriously encouraged to pursue these things. But, I want to...
Yes.
Yeah, go on. Is that...
No, you go on. At least I had feline parents.
You had feline, all right. All right.
Same family.
Okay. And so what I want to ask is, at that age of 4 or 5, were you just good at music, or did you already love it? Did you love it, at that age?
Well, I think this is a wonderful question. I come from a musical family, so music was around the house. My sister played violin, played piano. My father played violin. My mother sang, and she sang beautifully. And so it was, it was something that was part of the background of daily life. Did I love it? I think, as a child, I sort of think that often that before I was 15, I was in a preconscious state or a subconscious state.
Well, weren't we all?
Well, yes, absolutely. I'm, in developmental terms, I think you acquisition of language so that one is completely fluent. It's there's an age beyond which it's harder to acquire new languages, and I think you know, I was in right. that state of being a sponge, essentially just receiving all kinds of information, knowledge, and just kind of it becomes part of you. So I don't think there was a sense of saying, oh, I love it, I don't love it, except maybe with the violin, which was...
You don't love it.
which obviously I didn't take to it.
Yeah.
You know, it
yeah.
wasn't not necessarily... Yeah. I never questioned it. Obviously, I think as a child, when you can do something or do something well and you get attention for it, you get praise for it, it says, oh, you know, what a cute little boy, he can play this thing.
Yeah.
You know, that's
yeah.
There's a little bit of the positive reinforcement factor that you know, makes you think, oh, well, then this is... But I feel that my relationship with the sound world has been pretty much a journey of discovery all of my life, and it continues to be.
Mm-hmm.
That's a through line for my life. And I think I got fascinated by things. I remember a radio broadcast in on French television that I forget at what time. Let's say it's 6 p.m. or 7 p.m. Mm. And then this program would come on and says, Ici, New York. And, you know, there was a snippet of Aaron Copland's music. Ya-ba-ba, ya-ba-ba, ya-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. And I thought, gee, that's really interesting. You know, and thought no more about it, except that something about that moment, I still remember 50 years later.
Right, right. And there is this parallel, really not just parallel, but interconnected, interwoven fascination for you, or passion, alongside music, within music, with this whole adventure of what it means to be human. So I think it's interesting that even though you were something of a prodigy, that you didn't immediately pursue that. You went to Harvard and studied anthropology. I mean, do you think even early at that point, you know, did these things take up, you know, comparable places in you? This fascination with humanity and culture and your life with music.
Well, I think you point to a very consistent parallel development.
Mm-hmm.
Skill at an instrument versus sort of just trying to figure things out, trying to decipher people. I think I think my lifelong preoccupation in the human realm has always been who did it and why.
Say some more. You mean just everything that comes along? Those are the questions you want to ask?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, imagine a 7-year-old's mind going from a Parisian landscape of not tall buildings, but very interesting rooftops. Tiled rooftops, you know, sometimes with chimneys and whatever, to the landscape of rectangular buildings with an odd, at that time, water tower, you know, a wooden sort of barrel at the top of it, and, you know, thinking, what's that? What is its purpose? And who built these buildings that had such, you know, the pre-war buildings had such wonderful friezes and architectural detail that was, you know, I mean, it made me think, gee, who would have built that? You know, what happened here? Somebody did it, right? And this would go to practically every asset of life. And I think this is when, you know, you talk about the divide between St. Paul and Minneapolis. It's that same divide that says, you know, why do people have different habits?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
why is the yeah. bread square, white, and sliced versus, you know, a baguette that's with that wonderful scent of, you know, baked goods and, you know, in the morning when you go buy a patisserie, you know, and it's just like you want to grab the closest loaf of bread or croissant in your hand, and then going to sliced bread and square cheese that you peel off, you know, in the 60s. That's what we had,
yeah.
right? And so why was that different? And then to obviously to language and to behavior, to all kinds of things that I was receiving unconsciously, but probably, you know, early on starting to at least pose the question, why? How come?
And that the land of white sliced bread also had Aaron Copland.
Yeah, those connections came, I think, a little later.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think I was aware of Aaron Copland until I was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
But having somehow had an early interaction, didn't play with him, never did, with Leonard Bernstein.
Mm.
And then to find out that they were wonderful colleagues and friends and you know, then the recognition of relationship building came in, and that was, you know, that was ever so fascinating and continues to be.
So what you just described about experiencing this spectrum of, you know, how humanity expresses itself in different cultures with all these things, architecture, food. I mean, the realm that you immersed in and where you are, you know, a master is this realm of music. And the way you just talked about that actually helps me think about, you know, my sense that for you, then you are steeped in music as an entry point to all that. I don't even want to use the word diversity because it's just almost, you know, it's an overused word and it's almost too cold for what we're talking about, right? All that richness, all that variety.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Absolutely. I think Pablo Casals used to talk about, you know, the great cellist from Spain, from Catalan, one of my early and continues to be heroes. Talked about infinite variety.
Yeah, right.
And I think that's what I seek in, you know, in the mind's eye. You know, you look at the, to quote Carl Sagan, the billions and billions of stars out there. And, you know, what stirs the imagination of a young child? You look at the sky and you start wondering.
Right.
Where are we? You know, how do we fit into this vast universe? And to Casals saying that within the notes that he plays, he's looking for infinite variety.
Mm.
To Isaac Stern saying, you know, what actually happens, the music happens between the notes. So what does that suggest? It suggests that you have, let's say, two notes. You identify what they are. So you know the materiality of it. You have a name for it. You go from A to B. But if you take Stern's words seriously and say, okay, well, what then do you mean when you say music happens between the notes? Well, how do you get from A to B? Is it a, you know, is it a smooth transfer? It's automatic. It feels easy. You glide into the next note, or you have to reach to get to the. You have to physically or mentally or effortfully reach to go from one note to another. Could the next note be part of the first note, or could the next note be a different universe? You know, have mm-hmm. you just crossed into some amazing boundary and suddenly the second note is a revelation? So it's and it's your own mental setup when you're thinking about, okay, how am I going to, I can do it, let's say physically on an instrument, it's very easy to get from A to B.
Right.
But then I was during class last night and we were talking about precisely that. Sometimes in order to show expression, you have to show difficulty, even though it may be technically really easy. Other times, in order to show expression, something may be really, really hard technically. But if you want one thing to go to another seamlessly, you have to make it seem really easy. So it's about merging different aspects of one realm, which in the realm of playing an instrument is pure engineering.
Right.
You know, you can figure out
right.
exactly how to get there from this. You know, these are the levers you have to push, and this is how much you move your bow, and this is how where your fingers go. But the mental process, the emotional process, the psychic investment in trying to make something easy, infinitely hard, is something that takes enormous energy because in the engineering part of it, it's very simple.
Were there kind of pieces of music or, you know, experiences of working with other musicians or particular concerts? Like, have there been cathartic moments where you discovered this or started to be able to articulate it, or even something going on now? I'm just wondering if you could embed that in a piece of music or a story.
Sure. Well, I'll give you two.
Mm-hmm.
The first one, so one of the composers that wrote for cello alone, and Bach wrote six of these wonderful suites.
Yes.
And they're different movements. And if you take that Isaac Stern between the notes, what happens, you know, between the notes, I have a moment of going between the moment, the end of a movement, to the beginning of the next movement. So actually not necessarily coded or written in by the composer. They're just separate movements that I remember often playing the loving the connection between the end of the Sarabande of the G major suite going into the minuet, the next movement. Because there was something, a Sarabande is like a slow dance, and it goes into a minuet, which is a slightly more lively dance. Yeah. And there's something about the incredible restfulness of the way the first movement ends, and to just suddenly the sunlight comes in. You know, there's mm-hmm. a moment where you can go into nature at always at any moment and figure out some parallel to what is happening in a sound centric world. And that moment was amazing for me. I would always, you know, I wouldn't want to end the day playing just that, the end of one movement, without also including the other. And so there was, you know, there was a connective thing. So that's an early age memory. I think I spent when I was 12, I think I spent a year obsessing over a trio by Schubert. The second, the E-flat major trio. And there was a recording that I think, and on one of those old LPs, which is actually what we had then. Mm-hmm. So it's, of a recording by Alexander Schneider, Mieczysław Hruszowski on the piano, Alexander Schneider on the violin, and Pablo Casals on the cello. I think I wore that record out because there was something about that piece that just it was probably the first kind of big one piece of music presenting a coherent worldview.
Right.
You know, it's like a 40-minute long piece. So it's, you know, and there's another connection there because the second movement is one of the last pieces Schubert wrote, and he died fairly young. In fact, you know, was in his early 30s. And he was a great admirer of Beethoven. So I think when he heard Beethoven died, he wrote one of these funeral march movements. And so, you know, as usual, it's in a minor key. And there's a kind of a sigh at the end of a long phrase. Ba-dum, ba-dum, ba. And like a, you know, that's it's a descending third in minor. It's just very, very, it's, you know, it has a, obviously a funeral march has a rhythmic sense to it, a rhythmic flow to it. But then you are sighing away with that melody. And you go through that movement, which ends in a very desolate place. You go through another kind of a minuet thing, and then you have a last movement that's very bright, sort of folksy, and guess what happens at the end of that last movement? That theme from the second movement comes back. You have the repeat of that sing-songy feel of that sigh that comes at the end of the phrase. And then, after two repetitions of that, finally you get into, from bottom into a major bottom. And it's that moment that kind of explodes your world. You know, it's a difference of a half step and probably a 20-minute wait in between. So this is, you know, musical or visual or sensory architecture.
Mm.
You know, you've embedded something in someone's mind about one thing that is, you know, in itself gorgeous, beautiful. And then time passes by, whether it's 20 years or 20 minutes, it doesn't matter. And then you hear it again. But then there's that moment where it becomes major. And then the piece ends. I mean, it is truly one of the most, I mean, for a 12-year-old, probably the most spectacular thing that you could focus deeply on. And then the question remains, well, who was Schubert that was able to do that?
How did he do it? So there's your question again. Who did this and why?
Yeah, and how did he do it?
Yeah.
So how did Casals manage to keep our attention from, you know, for something that could have just passed by and nobody noticed? And how did Horshavsky keep the flow of rhythm and harmony going? How did Sasha Schneider manage to sort of carve every note out of something? I mean, as you start, I started thinking about, you know, music not as notes, but as you know, as materials. You think about, you know, notes. Sure, you can identify the notes, but if you ask someone to play or sing a note, you want it to feel like that it's light. Well, is it light from an incandescent light bulb? Is it light from a laser beam? Is it light that has tremendous energy or it just dissipates? What kind of light? You know, if it's wood, what kind of wood? Is it a hardwood?
Right.
Is it a soft wood? Is it, you know, chopped up? Is it a, if it's steel, is it what kind of, you know, if it's earth, what kind of minerality do you want to put in the sound? And what's amazing is that you know, we have words to describe all of these things, and you immediately feel what the wood feels like, or steel, what it sounds like.
Yes.
You know, you clang
yes.
on the piece of steel. Earth, you feel like, you know, your hand is digging into the earth, and maybe you're looking for worms. Maybe you're looking for, you know, pebbles or whatever. And for each thing that we describe in words, you have a tactile response,
yeah.
a sense.
It's a whole sensory.
Sensual.
Yeah.
yeah. And it's the same thing with music. So if you think, you know, you like to say that sound can be visual, well, I would claim the same thing, is that you know, if I go back to that Schubert piece, and there's one thing is in darkness, and then the next one, 20 minutes later, suddenly the light breaks through. And one thing is maybe more material, and the next thing may be more ethereal.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, yeah. it's telling stories, giving narrative, giving substance or meaning to something that's coded that I think gets us to want to be or want to be involved in a specific world that one is describing.
So you play and celebrate and encourage many, many, many kinds and forms and genres of music. But, you know, this example is classical music. And I did want to speak to you about, you know, classical music in the modern world, in a modern sensibility. And I wonder if you would say something about not why classical music is superior, but how classical music distinctively works for us and with us. I mean, it seems to me that what you're just describing there is this fullness and drama and sweep of that a piece, that a classical piece is capable of, and usually that's quite unusual, even compared to other kinds of complex music, but I don't know if that generalization works.
I don't know either, because again, you know, I both like to make sweeping generalizations, mm-hmm. and I also don't like to make sweeping generalizations.
Yeah, I know, me too.
So I'm always conflicted mm-hmm. In that sense, and I have friends that will keep me, you know, on the straight and narrow and true path by saying, no, actually, what you just said is not accurate
yeah.
because of this. And I have other friends that, you know, would encourage that. So it's kind of but if I were to take your first statement, sort of say, well, you know, as true, or what is different, or whatever, I think I would first of all say that the idea of classical music is kind of the definition of it bears reexamination. That in
okay.
some ways it's a false category. It's certainly a commercial category, because you can then, you know, with that category, you can go into a certain world and assume that there's a certain number of things that are going to be there.
Yeah.
But you know, some people would say, well, classical music is really, you know, its roots are church music, court music,
yeah.
and popular music.
Yeah.
So they're all mixed in. So, And so the sacred and the secular definitely are part of it, and the sacred, secular, and certainly the folk elements in Haydn and Mozart and Brahms, you know, the Roma people, it's all over the place.
Yeah, but you're right. That's not something that's consciously pointed at very often or named.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I mean by large generalizations.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the thing is, Let me give you an example. You're making a distinction between St. Paul and Minneapolis, the way that, because you go to both places and you see things very close up, so you could point out to differences, you know, the river, what happens when you cross the river, what's the tradition that has been built up in one place or another. Well, but let's talk about Sochi. You know, the Olympics.
Yeah.
What do we know about? So the further away we go, because it's further away, there's that great famous New Yorker cartoon that says, you know, for New York-centric people, it's Manhattan, there's a Hudson River, there's New Jersey, then there's, you know, the West Coast, and then there's Asia. So it's like you get to a larger and larger way of collecting an immense amount of information into one word. Oh, you're from California.
Yeah.
Oh, you're a West Coast person. Mm-hmm. Ah, you know, are you chilling? You know, it's like we make these and obviously we know it's not true, not quite true, but it serves a purpose.
Yeah, I even love though the shifting the you know that even thinking about musical as geographies rather than. You know, a timescape, right? Which is classical music. Yes, you're right. It sets it in time and makes it sound like something that once was.
Right. And so it's further away. Therefore, you can make a gross generalization.
Mm-hmm.
It's, oh, yes, it's dead white European music.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And, well, what about the classical great composers that came to not just North America, but to South America that took in all the influences of indigenous people, including especially in places like Brazil, the African traditions, and then created a different sound, a different thing that we all treasure. And
so who would you think of in that category? Just give me an example that people might know.
Let me use Argentina first. The music of Astor Piazzolla. Piazzolla tango, nuevo tango. You know, so here's a man who was born in Buenos Aires. His father was a barber. He came to New York for better life when he was a teenager, and he heard. He went in those days to jazz clubs in Harlem. Loved the music. Then they had to move back because they couldn't make a go of it. Later on, he went to Paris to study with Nadia Boulanger, and one of the greatest teachers of music ever, who influenced Stravinsky, Copland, and tons of musicians from everywhere. And she looked at his work and said, oh, you know, not bad. It's a good, you know, you're trying to sound like Bartok and it looks pretty good. Let me see some other stuff that you've written. And he shows her his tango-influenced music. And she said, wow, you know, the other stuff is okay. But this stuff, you should really continue because that is just, you know, outrageously fantastic. And so he went and then continued to write in that style. So he now has jazz in his background. He's had the contemporary classical skill sets in his background. He has a tango music in his background. So he goes back, he writes, you know, this new form of tango. And there's this famous story that he goes into a taxi, in Buenos Aires, and as soon as the cab driver recognized Piazzolla, says, get out. You are the one that ruined tango. So here's this man who's gone through, you know, many things, had lots of different experiences all embedded in his work. He's evolving something. And so Piazzolla to this day is claimed by everybody. He's claimed by world music, classical musicians, jazz musicians. You know, he's one of us because he's put in and people recognize the in his music, their own DNA in it.
Hmm. So if you could propose, if you could replace the words classical music with another phrase or some other words, what would they be?
I would say that, most people who've tried, they just say music, you know.
Yeah.
music of our world, or any kind of, and obviously classical music, which had roots in improvisation. Bach, Mozart, Beethoven were some of the greatest improvisers of their time. Mm. And in fact, were renowned for what they were able to do, but then also wrote things down. We know their work because there were no recordings at the time of the music that they wrote down. Mm. So I would, I would have a template for just good musicians as people who know something.
Good
very,
music.
Very, yeah, good yeah. music. Look, or any type of music can be part of good music in the sense that, but I'm not even saying good music. I'm saying good musicians.
Yeah, right.
Would be able to, to compose, mm-hmm. to improvise, to be virtuosic in what they do, and can easily absorb other influences and make it organically their own, so that new influences are embedded. So there's the process of constant growth, and then finally, the last quality would be the musician that actually is able to transfer, to inject all of their knowledge, and give it to somebody else, so that they can actually look at the world and figure it out for themselves without. The first musician being there. So giving independence to that knowledge. So whatever you own that's yours, you can actually give to somebody else so that it exists independently. It's a process of birth. It's a process of constant cultural rebirth.
That's lovely. So it seems to me also that even as you described, you've sometimes spoken of a forensic musicology that you were talking about Schubert. You're asking who did this and why? Why? It seems to me you're also doing that all the time in your life of music with creators, musical creators who are with us, playing music, making music with so many others, and. It seems to me that, and I was discussing this with somebody yesterday who had actually seen you in concert, I believe, with Emmanuel X.
Mm-hmm.
There's this quality of listening, and I don't know if that's the right word or if that's the word you would use, but of you, listening to and with another musician. So do you know what I'm describing, and how would
Sure.
you describe it?
I think you and I know that no matter what you say, how you say it, the actual reception of words and intention from another person is always a little different from what you may have intended. That's why telephone is so interesting to play, right? You say something to somebody and then go around. By the time it comes back to you, it often could be something very different.
Yeah.
But I think in some ways what I know musicians try to do is to ramp up awareness.
Yeah, I mean, listening is not just about what you're hearing, right? It's about leaning in with your whole presence.
Right,
and picking
exactly.
up
That's
their
right.
presence, right?
Yeah. I think all of what music tries to do simplest way of describing anything that happens in music is what is regular and what is irregular. So, meaning that you have to have a base from which you say this is that something that we're springing from. Uh-huh. But if you just describe that base, it's not particularly interesting. So at some moment, it has to become irregular to say, oh, wow, you know, I want to grab that moment. Uh-huh. And I think it's that the tension or dichotomy between those two factors that gives us the what we might call ordinary to extraordinary. And how do you do that? Well, having so you usually when you go to the supermarket, you may not be at your most intense aware listening. You know, you're looking for the feel of the vegetable, you know, and you're looking for something, but you may be thinking other thoughts. But when you're totally aware, when you're in, you know, in the pocket, in the zone, in the, you know, in that state of mind that is open to the state of mind that the like a piece of music requires, then you are focused, but also tremendously wide open.
Yeah.
And you want to be in that state. So one state that I could describe is that I like to think of, you know, we've all been for obviously, hopefully every day between the state of awake and asleep. And in that state, I would like to make a claim that your consciousness may have access to all the experiences of your unconsciousness. So you have access to both. But you're not incredibly active, because to be active requires a different kind of mechanism that takes a certain amount of brain space. But in the brain space of where you're physically, you know, in a state of, let's say, repose, sometimes, do you ever think that you have great ideas that when you're almost awake, just before you're asleep, you said, oh my gosh, and you want to write it down, because if you don't, you're going to forget it.
It'll go. Right?
It goes into your temporary memory and it just goes away. It's like dreams, right? If you don't somehow activate the memory bank of remembering the dream you just woke up with, you'll forget it later on. More or less.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the state I think, one of the states that you want to be in order to be maximally aware of your environment so that you can react to it.
So when
you have to react to it physically, when you're playing
music with someone, you're in that state. That's really interesting.
But you're in two different states, but you have to kind of switch back and forth.
Yeah.
Because you can't, you know, in that first state, you can't be, if you start to move around a lot, you kind of lose that.
Yeah.
So you have to kind of both be in the state of being able to react and, you know, in with great immediacy, but at the same time, you have to switch back and forth to that other state that actually allows for anything that comes in to be – that needs to be different, you can react to. You can kind of – you can conjure up. You can be in full connectedness with your imagination bank.
Yes. And so there's a – you know, and I think this may be important to name, because if somebody sees you on stage, they're, you know, and even if you're together with someone else, this other person is very, you know, skilled, and there's a feeling of control, right? Of you know, mastery, perfection, or you know, but what you're that experience you're describing it involves is vulnerable, right? I mean, and, you know, so my analogy, which is quite different, but still, I think you know that the difference between listening, which is waiting for the other person to talk and then asking the next question that's on the page, you know, the listening, which is entering a conversation and being open to taking in whatever happens and not, in fact, then being in charge of what will happen.
Absolutely.
You know, that feeling that anything could happen is what can make something wonderful. I mean, that's what you're describing. But it's, I think that the state you're in and the experience you're having and that you're making is much more vulnerable than an audience might realize.
Well, I think yes and no, because, you know, I think remind you, we're only describing two different states so far,
okay.
Right? And
okay.
And I think another state of mind is, yes, a lot of artists will say, oh, you know, I have to make myself so vulnerable. And that is absolutely true. It's like you have to open up. You can't be so – if you're well defended, you know – I'm going to show you how strong I am, then that precludes the idea of saying, actually, I'm very weak. Mm-hmm. You know, because weakness can be a strength as a form of expression.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So if you only show strength, you're showing a one-dimensional aspect of something that you're trying to describe. If you only show weakness, obviously one thing. But if you show both,
yeah.
And you show the variety in between, then you have you're describing a multidimensional world,
yeah,
right? Which is what we are, I guess.
Yeah.
So I think another state that I'm fond of describing is you know, when I come to Minneapolis, I'm a guest in your town, so I need to do. You know, I need to respect what happens in Minneapolis. I don't make a lot of jokes about Minneapolis. Kidding. But when I'm on stage, all of you that are in the hall are my guests.
Mm.
So I'm the host of a wonderful party. You're all my guests. And which means that because you know, I've got I have the floor. You know, I have the floor with my colleagues, and we want you to have a wonderful, you know, whatever, hour and a half, 25 minutes, yeah. Whatever it is. While I'm on stage, you are all my guests, because that's sort of like the unsaid agreement. So while you're my guest, if something bad happens on stage, I often think of Julia Child. You know, oh, the chicken's fallen on the floor. Yes. Oh, we'll pick it up and put it right back. It's like, you know, and you know what? Everybody's with you.
Right.
Because, and even if nobody's going to touch the chicken, they're not going to let that moment spoil their evening. Mm. They'll remember, oh, yes, you know.
Oh, that's so great. That's such a great image for life, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. So, you know, it's like, oh, well, this happened, yeah. You know, boom. But actually, that's not why we're here, to watch the bad things that happen. And so it's – so whatever you practice for on the engineering side that fails is all right, because we have a greater purpose. The greater purpose is that we're communing together, and we want this moment to be really special for all of us, because otherwise why bother to have come at all?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's not like, you know, it's not about how many people are in the hall. It's not about, oh, this is, you know, it's not about proving anything.
No.
It's about sharing something.
It's about being whole together too, isn't it? Which includes,
yeah, there's
all
something
those
that's
things
so
that could go wrong.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
It's so, and you know, rewind to September 11th. On the morning of September 11th, I was in Denver. At 9 o'clock, my wife calls me and says, you know, turn on the television. Yeah. Something bad is happening. Turn on the television. I'm supposed to go to Colorado Springs on the 11th and to Denver to play another concert on the 12th and the 13th in Phoenix, Arizona. Three different orchestras. And so in the wake of this, you know, horrific thing, every orchestra and had to decide, do we cancel or do we play? Hmm. And what every orchestra decided to say was, we're going to play. We may change the program a little. We're going to actually, you know, be together and have a moment of literally of being together. And music will be the way that we will come together, because we're asserting ourselves as a community, as a people, as a city, as whatever, and we need to be together. So to this day, yeah. Now this is now how many, 12 years later, if I go back to any of those places, not a single person does not remember vividly what that evening meant, you know.
And, you know, I think that's a wonderful image for some language you use of being a citizen artist, and that this insistence that this must be at the table, arts, as we, in music, as we define ourselves culturally and weighted as defining alongside politics and economics and the things we discuss in a more, that we sometimes seem to take more seriously.
Well, I think, you know, it depends how much room we have for what, you know. So if very often, you know, if I'm in a particular profession, that thing and how well I do in that profession can become a totally all-encompassing preoccupation. And the thing is, you know, again, what is it and why? What are we doing here? Yeah. What? Who are we? And I often ask musicians, what do you think of yourselves as, you know, the instrument that you play as your identity? Or do you think of yourself as a musician? Or do you think of yourself as a human being? And what is the ratio between the three? I think that, you know, the citizen part is the part of the, is somewhere towards the human part, because we're looking at, you know, how we fit in within society. And if we look at our Constitution, you know, that is, we have an ideal of what our nation could and should be like. And then we have laws that suppose, you know, try to implement what those things might be. And now let's look at our voting record. Let's look at how many people vote, right? There are very few things that are required of us as citizens. So how do we participate? I know I, for one, often feel frustrated to say, you know, there's so many things that are happening and I have nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
I'm not connected to it. So therefore, I can't care about it because it's just a waste of time and energy because it's all beyond me. Now, that's kind of like giving up.
And I think that's an experience so many people have, so many people who do different things in different corners. Yeah.
That's right. So, you know, it's all Washington's fault.
Right, right.
You know, it's as if, like, as soon as you enter into the Beltway, you know, you become, you know, like, you change. You turn into something different from what I think you should be. And it's like, so there's something that's not, or it's Occupy Wall Street, or it's, You know, it's entitlements, or it's, you know, it's, we always, it's really easy to say it's not my fault, it's someone else's fault. But ultimately, if we are the democracy that we claim to be, it does require full participation. You know, and that's the anomaly that I'm sort of trying to wrestle with in myself too. You know, so this is not about, oh, look at me. I'm trying to understand this thing because so in my view as a musician, I'm thinking, okay, well, what in the world can I do?
Yeah.
You know, let me find some ways. Okay, there's the public education crisis. Let's go into something where I feel maybe we might be needed and where we can help out. You know, essentially it's like what my wife always says to me, don't just make lists, just ask, you know, what can I do to help?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Right. You know, and just ask me, what can I do to help right now? And I think if we ask, if we even start to look, you will find lots and lots of needs.
Yeah, I love this language of Rilke about living the questions. And I think there is something powerful about posing the question. You can't live into it unless you ask it.
Right. But once you ask it, mm-hmm. you see, you already put yourself in a position of slight vulnerability because you don't know the answer.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, I think there's part of us that wants, all of us want a certain kind of stability and security to say, you know, this is, you have too much security, you get bored.
Yeah.
but you need something. But we are sometimes living in an age where everybody needs to have the right answer. But then if everybody has the right answer, they contradict one another, then obviously, you know, it's not always
nobody. We're not getting anywhere.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's, you do have to put yourself in a more vulnerable state. And I think that by doing that, you can actually begin to see where the solutions may lie. At least you start to open yourself to someone else who might propose a solution that start to lead us in a certain position.
Yeah, that's great.
Not to the position of always being right, but mm-hmm. in a position that actually solves pressing problems mm-hmm. and needs and recognizing needs. And I think that's where the basis of you know, a cultural citizen or citizen musician comes in, because I think that, you know, as musicians, so music actually very easily crosses spaces.
Yeah.
You know, you go from people's earbuds into concert halls, into living rooms, into cars, into what. So it can exist across a lot of different physical spaces and geographical spaces.
Which
can be huge.
Yes.
It can be huge. It
yes.
exists in, you know, and so one part of music may not be good, but then maybe it's really alive in choruses and churches in a particular state, you know,
mm-hmm.
or the bands may be incredible in one state, but then there's no room for that in another one. There could be, you know, you could have all kinds of strengths and in different places at different times. And I think when there are groups like Community Music Works that, you know, this group from, well, you must know them from Brown.
Yeah.
They started the, so a quartet that graduated from.
Singing, yeah.
Yeah. And they took over a storefront. And I think Sebastian, who runs it now, you know, it's, and they've actually revitalized a certain area of Providence, and they've become kind of a community center where people feel safe. They come for music, they
right,
come for
right.
lessons, whatever, and they've been honored by all kinds of, you know, awards, MacArthur's, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But this is a group of people who probably, when you graduate from college, if you're lucky to go to college, you graduate from college, you're thinking, uh-oh, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
Right? What am I going to do with my life? Well, they found a way that I think, you know, thinks, I think that's great citizenship.
Yeah, yeah, right. I want to ask you, I'm curious about your relationship with your cello or your cellos. You probably have, do you have more than one or do you have one?
Yeah, I play on a number of instruments. Okay. Two of them are old and several of them are new.
I mean, you know, and I'm wondering, is it like a part of your body? Is it like a friend? Is it like a family member? Can you talk about that?
As usual, I feel two ways about it.
Mm-hmm.
See how conflicted I am. You know, it's a wonder I can get up in the morning. Should I get up? Why should I get up? Who am I that thinks I should get up? You know, it gets very confusing. I love the instruments I play, but I also like to be separate from them, and so I think the image I have of the four strings of the instrument and the bow I use is that the bow, which draws out sound, are the lungs.
Mm-hmm.
And the strings that are on the instrument are the vocal cords. So, you know, so if you think of Stephen Hawking, who can't speak and who can't whatever, but just by a slight movement of either the eyes or a finger can actually, you can get to hearing words that he is thinking that comes out and we actually then hear his voice through a series of amazing mechanical inventions, but we really hear the construction of his thinking pattern. And I think of instruments as sort of the extension of, you know, the lungs and the vocal cords. Mm. And so you live with what you have. You know, you live with the vocal cords you have, with the lungs you have, and the instruments are, you know, great pieces of, in a way, of sculptural architecture, you know, designed to give life to sound and beauty and all of those aspects. And, you know, I can talk a lot about sort of, you know, the golden periods of certain instrument making and why it became that way, whatever. But for now, it's really, these are relationships with separate instruments, and each of them has a different quality. The Stradivarius I play on is more of a tenor instrument, meaning that the core sort of sound, that, you know, the greatest string might be the top string. A Montagnana, a Venetian instrument I play on, may have as its core the lower string. Mm. So it becomes more like a bass baritone. And so there are differences, the way the differences in wines, in all kinds of...
In voices, in human voices also.
In human voices, mm-hmm. Right. And so you try and work with the specific characteristics of the instrument, and then you try and balance out what needs to be in another space, which is... if it's a concert hall that you're playing in, I think of each concert hall as a different instrument because each concert hall has separate qualities. You know, so obviously in a theater, it has a dry acoustic because you really want to hear words. But in a place like Orchestra Hall in
Minneapolis,
it is mm-hmm. in Minneapolis. It is reverberant because it wants to blend the sounds of various instruments. And so it has a longer reverb, you know, 2 seconds or something. So, and then there are multi-purpose halls that are configured for whatever the needs may be. If it's a conference, obviously on the drier side, if it's, you know. So I think knowing the space that you're in is really important and matching it and using the instrument that you know with its qualities so that so in a dry hall you may want to warm up the sound on stage. In a very reverberant hall, you may want to make sure that if you're playing a lot of fast things with articulation, you know, you don't want it to sound like, right? Because if it's, so you need to kind of space things out, and one instrument may be better at spacing things out, another may be better at creating a warm sound. I'm not saying that you match the instrument to each hall, but that you just want to know the characteristics so you can start to work in a way that works for the listener.
So you're never even just working with the instrument. You're working with the instrument and the environment.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So it's the environment. And as I love to say to people that want to listen to me is that if you're going to perform someplace, please don't fall in love with what you've constructed. It's like in the Marines, don't fall in love with your plan. Because the plan's always going to change. And you need to make sure that the audience is the most important person in the room.
Oh.
Because if you want to make something that's, you know, that's memorable for somebody else, as well as for yourself, you want them, the purpose of playing, of doing live music is that it's like a witness of you know, a communal witnessing of something. And if the audience member forgets and says, honey, what did we do last night? You know, you're an abject failure. Okay. Even if the hall was packed. You know, it's like, why was I there? You know?
Yeah.
And if I forget at the end of the year where I was, then, you know, that kind of lessens the impact of what I would hope to have achieved. So it's like, you know, I started thinking about that in my 20s because I was playing so many concerts at the end of the year. Sometimes I would say, you know, I have no idea what happened between, you know, September and November or January and May because it was so long ago.
Right.
I don't. And I'm thinking, well, there's something unhealthy about this.
So, you know.
You know, it becomes, yeah.
Well, somebody said to me, who'd seen you perform up really close. I think maybe when you, it's one of my producers, I think maybe it's when you did a performance at NPR. Maybe you were being interviewed there. And she said in a way that she had never seen before since, she said that you radiated joy. And I'm curious about, and I've seen that at a little more of a distance in your performances, and I wonder if is that something you're conscious of? Is it something that developed over time? Has developed over time?
Well, I think it has some connection to the hosting and guest thing. Imagine being a host of a party and walking out and saying, "Oh, so you're here."
Right. But in your 20s, when you're saying, you know, when you're talking about your 20s, when you maybe couldn't remember all the places you'd been, I mean, is this a presence that you grew into, that you settled into?
Possibly. I mean, I don't have that good a memory for, you know, a state of mind of, you know, from 30 years ago, 40 years ago. So I think that... I think there are a couple things I think about, that if you're doing something, this is the public-private thing, that if you're doing something in public, you have to be responsible for what you're putting out. And because, you know, it's that part of that host thing.
Yeah.
You know, because especially if you have a public that's, you know, that works hard, has taken time out of their lives to come to something, there's again, an unspoken contract may be too strong a word, relationship or some expectation between what is, you know, what their expectations are, what your expectations are, and what, you know, what are we doing there? I think on radio, it's the same thing. You just, if you can't be a pessimist.
You don't have to be joyful, right? And I don't think that's something either that you can manufacture. You can be gracious without being joyful.
But true.
There's some quality to your presence in when you're playing your music, maybe all the time. I just wonder, do you feel that, or is it just something about you?
Well, maybe maybe the joyfulness could be the hope of joy.
Hmm.
You know, it doesn't.
The intention.
You know, yeah. Uh-huh. I think, you know, I often say optimism is a philosophy.
Hmm.
Unless you're obviously, you know, 24/7 optimistic. Well, then it could be a blessing and a curse.
But, right.
Your dog died. Oh, really? How wonderful.
But I think I hear you saying you choose joy.
I think so. Well, certainly in performing, I think that is a choice. Because, you know, it really doesn't matter where I am in life, but I truly am happy and grateful that people have taken the time to show up.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, you go to a memorial service, and if you are the person that's hosting the memorial service, you say to people, I'm happy you came.
Hmm.
Right? I mean,
yeah.
You don't say, oh, I can't talk to you right now because I'm, you know, you somehow, so it's, you can layer joy over grief. You can layer mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean it's absolutely something that
isn't that also. I feel, you know, we talked about how the limits of calling it classical music, but the great classical music, or what it just the great music. Well, it's true. Great music has this capacity to evoke and contain and encompass many different emotions all at once, the way our lives do.
Right. I think so. That's right. And there was this thought that at various historical moments that, you know, that music is a form of elevated living. There was that sense, you know, that there was it was used for, you know, nationalistic purposes. Oh, I must create the music, the sound of my country, you know, and it's Hungary. No, this is the French traditions. This is the Italian tradition, the bel canto, you know, and there's a pride of something associated with it, and a kind of a yearning toward something we want to be. Obviously, entertainment, social, all of that. But in the classical realm, it is, there was the sense of, Boulanger used to talk of music, Nadia Boulanger, who was this great French teacher that taught, you know, Piazzolla and Copland and Stravinsky. And she used to say that being a musician for her was a priesthood.
Hmm.
That, you know, you really are, it's something you serve in. It's something different than we think of. Well, in the States, for example, I'm categorized when we do our tax statements or when we enter a country as an entertainer.
Right.
Which, you know, so
yeah.
So it doesn't matter what I think I am, but you know, in the eyes of the law, of the government, I'm an entertainer.
But that doesn't really do it, does it, at all?
Well, no, but I am. Well, you know, it does. It can. And, you know, if I'm a host, I'm, you know, I'm entertaining guests. And, you know, I'm not saying that that elevates or cheapens it. I'm just saying this is a word.
Yeah.
But you could read into the word whatever you want. But I think that... You know, but in the tradition that we're talking about, you know, and with the example of Nadia Boulanger saying that
about that to be a musician,
that you are a priest,
yeah,
you are entering into a priesthood. You serve that. You're looking for an elevated sense of being in existence, at least, you know, that the music should. Somehow make us better.
Yeah.
Now, of course, we live in the 21st century, and I'm not sure whether something like that works. I would like to think that that's certainly part of what we try to do.
You know, there's... I looked back... getting ready to interview you at that appearance you made in Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
Oh.
Back in the 20th century.
I love
Mr. Yeah, I know you do. It was clear that you do. And I was so struck. Now, I think I was watching, I don't know where this came from, YouTube or something, but I didn't hear you answer this question. But to the point you just said about the great, you know, potentially the great responsibility, the priesthood of being a musician. You know, he ended by saying, "Do you know what a present that is when you play something for somebody? It's just like giving them a present."
That's so typical of Mr. Rogers, isn't it?
Yeah.
Speaking of which, you know, so we think of him as, you know, the children's program that he created for so many decades. And what's funny is Mr. Rogers... lives on.
Yes.
I mean, there's so many legions of people that that grew up with him and they're still in a way growing up with him and he of course was a minister. And
I forgot that. I had forgotten that.
And his children are you know, the children of the show in the neighborhood mm-hmm. are his ministry. And what a beautiful thing that is. I think that when I play for people, it's not a transaction.
Yeah.
See, that's the thing that's really important. So, again, we separate ourselves because, you know, nowadays we are considered, you two are a brand. You know, you're mm-hmm. a commercial entity. There's a certain commercial value to what you do, to the program. There's all of that. But if I ask you, Christy, what is your value, that probably would not be the first thing that comes out of your mouth.
No.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So there are other things that come in first, but that's – but, you know, everything is – so it's in fact a kind of it's all about priorities. Priority and value. For Mr. Rogers, his audience, his children were his priority in this, and I can prove it because whenever people wrote to him, he wrote back handwritten letters
right.
in his beautiful script. And he would, and whenever someone wrote to him about something, you know, involving my appearance on the show, he would send a photocopy of that letter and his response to them. Okay, that's a level of detail and concern that I think is, you know, it's hard to emulate because, boy, that takes so much time.
Well,
but that's a model. We can strive towards the state of being, you know, in Mr. Rogers' orbit, but you know, few of us would ever succeed in doing that, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't strive towards it. Because what he did was he created a safe world for children, and where all the doubts of a child, if your parents are getting divorced, what does that mean? If you're in the bathtub and the water is going down the drain and you're a toddler, might you also go down the drain? You know, yeah. Those childish, childlike fears, and that he was able to create that safe virtual world, and
was
amazing. And to this day, you know, there are people that are great Mr. Rogers fans, and then there are people who are socialized who say, oh, my gosh, you know, that's really boring. And, well, because often when a parent comes home and they feed the fish and, you know, toss their sneakers up in the air, it's not particularly meant to be exciting. It's just, you know, your parent's back. And it's like, I to this day, when someone says, you know, what are you most proud of to have accomplished? One of the things I always say, and I never say more than two things, I say that to have appeared in these children's shows.
Mm. And Arthur was another one, right?
20 years later,
yeah.
Someone comes up to me and says, you know what? I saw this episode. This is what it made me want to do.
Right.
And they would stand in line, you know, backstage, wait for half an hour, you know, go through. And they're like, you know, late teenagers or people who don't necessarily have that much patience. And to know that that's the effect of what he has done for millions of people that's, you know, I am so proud to have been part of that.
It's a wonderful image also of, you know, as you say, he was also an entertainer for tax purposes, probably, but entertainment is a kind of gift economy.
A gift economy. I like that.
Yeah.
Can I borrow that?
Yes, you can absolutely borrow it. Relational, yes. Not transactional.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
We just have a few minutes, but I think that this has been just so wonderful, and there's so many other, you know, I feel like I could talk to you for hours. But I think maybe where I'll end is... I'm collecting, you know, definitions of beauty. I feel like beauty is, so I'll give you some that I love. You know, in Islam, beauty is a core moral value. You know, scientists and mathematicians, and you've named a few, you know, talk about, you know, if an equation is not elegant and beautiful, it's probably not true. There's this equation of beauty with truth. The philosopher and poet John O'Donohue said, "Beauty is that in the presence of which we feel more alive." I wonder. I mean, beauty is a word you've used in this conversation. You use it a lot. Obviously, it's just there in what you do, whether you're talking about it or not. I wonder if you'd talk to me about the meaning of beauty for you, or the power of beauty in the world.
Wow. What a simple question.
I know.
I think I can't say the word beauty without also equating it with the word transcendence.
Mm.
Because it seems like, you know, there's so many different things that are beautiful to so many different people. But I think beauty is often an encapsulation of a lot of different things in a certain moment, a frame, let's say. It could be, yeah. You know, music. It could be a poem. It could be an event. It could be in nature, possibly most often in nature. But I think when that encapsulated form is received, there's a moment of reception and cognition of the thing that is some ways startling.
Yeah.
And, you know, the moment you solve an equation, you know, the moment that that you something is revealed in either in your own head or physically, materially revealed, there's when that moment happens, when in the Sistine Chapel, when, you know, when you see the finger, you know, Adam, just about to die. There's that moment where something is being transferred. I think even when we observe nature, so if we are part of nature and we observe nature, but we're part of the human realm, and there's that moment which essentially there's a transfer of life.
Hmm.
So even if you think, you know, nature is inanimate and therefore, but the beauty of nature, but it's the human cognition of that vastness, the awe and the wonder and the, you know, something that's in a way bigger than yourself. You can go into the micro world and discover, you know, how a virus turns itself on and off. That could be an enormous, amazing moment, even though it's in a micro world.
But you know, when
it
you,
is something that's bigger than ourselves.
When you that phrase, it's a transfer of life, I think is also a wonderful way to talk about music, about what happens when you, in the experience of music, of playing it, making it or receiving it.
Well, I think that's true. You know, in the Silk Road Ensemble, I'm fond of being able to quote a number of incidents where that when, you know, when the Kou Umezaki, the shakuhachi player, which is a bamboo flute, when he plays a piece of music that was written after, let's say, I think the Tokyo fire of 1927, and he plays this sort of thing over and over again, and it's kind of it's certainly deeply spiritual and mournful. I've had more people come to me and say, you know, this is the most extraordinary thing I've heard. Or, you know, and Christina Pato is a Galician bagpiper, plays a gaita, and she and Wutong come across the stage at one another or with Ko, you know, so a bagpipe and a shakuhachi, and they're playing a song, a Galician song that that is the equivalent of when someone crosses the River Styx. You know, you go from the world to the underworld, and there's the boatman that carries you through. And they walk across the stage. And, you know, that to me, you know, I get the goosebumps of seeing this, you know, incredibly wonderful but very powerful and penetrating instrument. And with the two of them just crossing by, you know, I get a time, space, geography sort of crossing moment that cognitively makes me aware of the vastness of what, you know, of what basically humans all over the world have been trying to express for millennia. You know, whether it's cave paintings in Lascaux or it's Buddhist paintings in you know, Dun Huang, or it's St. Peter's, or, you know, it's I mean, people have for ages been trying to code the awesomeness of what, you know, of the infinite variety of
there
possibilities
we are, back in infinite
of
variety.
Creation.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, like, you know, with the Silk Road Ensemble, it's really that kind of thing where we're trying to join people together in what might be an unusual way, but in fact has become more and more the usual, which elicits sometimes in people, you can turn fear into joy when you receive something that's living, that's in, that goes inside you because it becomes your own.
Right.
You know, I think forever we've been debating the, you know, us versus them type issue.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I feel that is so great within our country that, you know, people are talking about economic competition, political competition. It's now what's Russia doing and what's, you know, all of the stuff that's always in the news. But one of the things we don't talk about is that within our country, within our demographics, we actually contain pretty much almost all of the world's population groups.
So all of them are in us. So.
Exactly. And but if we use that really well, mm-hmm. that means we have actually access into the hearts and minds of everybody in the world only if we use our own population mm-hmm. well and to do it, you know. And that's a very powerful thing, because if we do that, then our decisions, our cultural, our economic and political decisions will be based on much greater knowledge, and we will probably make fewer mistakes in our plans.
Just where you started about the thing that, you know, I think even your spiritual sensibility from the earliest days was this pursuit, this desire to understand. And I almost hear you saying, like, in everything you do and through your music, the pursuit of understanding itself also is a thing of beauty, a source of beauty.
Well, that's a quest, you know. I mean, yeah. It's probably a lifelong quest, and you know, which is, of course, you know, it's never ending, and but you don't want to make, well, you know, you don't want to make the well, the question is, there's the Faustian bargain, right? I mean, so people have written about it. You don't want to make that Faustian bargain. And yet you want to understand. And that's a conflict in itself.
I'm glad you mentioned Silk Road, because we'll obviously mention that in the show.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but did you want to book more time?
No, we need to close. I wonder, is there anything else you wanted to say? Anything to finish? We went so many places.
Well, you're so amazing, and you know, talking with you is every bit as enlightening as I could have possibly hoped. And really, I would just close with saying that just to follow that thought is that, you know, what we've tried to do in Silk Road over the last 15 years, you know, crossing boundaries and all that is actually, I hope, is one of many models that's available to us to try and actually bring our country together so that it is the most vibrant and creative and enlightened citizenry, because we have this population base, because we have those ideals, because we, you know, we say we do, and we just, you know, and if we act on it in, you know, each one of us, and we find ways where we can do that, then we create our own network that would be, you know, incredibly powerful and enlightening at the same time.
Well, it's just been a thrill to speak with you. I'm so looking forward to turning this into radio. I think it's going to be probably later this month or next month. We'll let you know when that's happening. It will be so fun to layer this with music, which we can do, you know,
with
the one beauty of radio. So just thank you. I think we have to release your studio.
Thank you. It's so great to speak with you, and all best to you. I hope we get to meet
in person. Yes, I'd love that too. I'll try to make that happen. Thank you so much.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thank you, Krista. Bye-bye.